Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hey, y'all. This is Carol in South Carolina, and you're listening to and dancing to the theme song of The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and thank you to Carol Allen, who you heard beautifully introducing the show there and suggesting that people might be dancing along to the theme music, which is, quite frankly, something that had never occurred to me before. So thank you, Carol, for that lovely mental image. I'm here, Catherine Whittaker. Matt's here. And when I say here, I mean here.
Hello. Yes. Physically in the same room recording a podcast together for the first time in a few months.
Great. The flesh. Disappointingly, David Law is not here. Now, that was planned. David Law had booked a much needed holiday. We were all very excited and pumped for David Law taking a holiday, getting a tan, getting some rest and relaxation. He was under strict orders not to look at his phone until the evenings.
Yeah, not to send a single tweet while he was away.
Oh, those were very strict instructions. And he was acquiescing to all of it. Holiday Law was in motion. And then Holiday Law tested positive for COVID-19. Now, I know a lot of people have had a rough old time of it with COVID-19. It's been a bit of a blight on our lives for the last couple of years, hasn't it? Safe to say. But for David Law, he's had the rough end of the COVID-19 stick, hasn't he? And he deserves a break. And we are desperately hoping that he can test negative in time to still get somewhat of a holiday that he so desperately needs and deserves. So we're sending positive vibes to David et famille, aren't we, Matt?
We are, yes. And we know he's listening to this. So positive vibes, David. David is absolutely listening to this.
He is. He's checking up on us, isn't he?
David listens to ones that he's already recorded. He definitely listens to ones that he's not on.
He does. He's feeling okay, folks. Touch wood, that continues to be the case, but I'm sure he will appreciate you sending positive vibes into the universe, and fingers crossed the next time we record a podcast he will be on his way to getting a tan. Billie Jean isn't here right now. She has been here. She fawns over Matt so much that I had to book her into daycare for the day in order to get this podcast recorded, quite frankly, or else Matt would not have had any hands free to record the microphone, to hold the microphone, rather.
Yes, it's been lovely seeing Billie Jean. I wandered in yesterday from Craven Cottage, which is about 45-minute walk from here, having seen Fulham just lose to Coventry. Wasn't a great afternoon, but as soon as I saw Billie Jean, things were better. I need Billie Jean in my life after a Fulham defeat all the time.
Yeah, get the violins out for Matt. That's just about your sort of second defeat of the season or something. Anyway, anybody that's considering having some football-related sympathy with Matt Roberts, I'll stop you in your tracks right there. He's fine, folks. Divert your sympathy elsewhere. Right then, it's time to talk about tennis. It's been a bit of a bit of a bitty week on tour. There are a few nice stories speckled around. We've obviously had Monte Carlo get underway, the first of the big men's clay court tournaments. We've actually got it on the screen in front of us right now. It's getting off with a bang with Fabio Fognini and Arto Rinderknecht. Although actually it started yesterday, didn't it? It's a Sunday start event, is Monte Carlo. We'll be talking about that and previewing the tournament and the clay court season in general in due course, but we'll deal with the past first and events that we saw last week on the tennis calendar. And the two biggest were in Charleston on the WTA and in Houston on the ATP Tour. And we had two first-time clay court champions in Belinda Bencic and Riley Opelka. Not two names, Matt, that I associate with clay court tennis.
No, definitely not. And I think we should probably start with Belinda Bencic, with Charleston being the slightly bigger event. And no, I really don't associate her with clay. She's now won a title on every surface, so she's, you know, she is an all-court player. But I also don't associate her with being like an amazing fighter on court. And that's probably a bit unfair. That probably is just an illustration of how you can pigeonhole players a little bit. And her game style is so smooth and so easy on the eye that is what I think of when I think of Belinda Bencic. But actually this week she showed what a brilliant competitor she is. She had a lot of really tough matches. I think she was a couple of points away from defeat even in the very first round. She had to fight through a host of really good players and good performances, Barossa, and then the final against Ons Jabeur in particular. She had to really fight, and on a surface which doesn't necessarily suit her game, even though she's got a great tennis IQ, and I think clay perhaps does bring out some of that and some of that strategy that she can employ. It's a really, really impressive week from Bencic, sort of continuing on from what she showed in Miami, which again is something I don't necessarily associate with Bencic. I sometimes think of her as having isolated great weeks, but at the moment she's in a really, really great bit of form. And yeah, this was a really impressive title for her.
She celebrated big, didn't she? It seemed like quite an emotional victory for her. Ons Jabeur wanted it desperately, didn't she? Of course, she has got over that hump of winning her first title, but you know, that was last year. She wants more. That was, you know, ticking off a milestone. And I think she referenced that in her social media post afterwards, didn't she? Saying, you know, that's been a few sort of heartbreaking final losses now. And, you know, there were moments in that final, obviously, particularly after Jabeur won that second set, where it really felt like she was on a roll and she was, you know, hitting some absolutely dreamy shots, wasn't she, and celebrating them big, you know, really sort of getting in Bencic's face and saying, I'm the one with the momentum here, I'm the one that wants it the most. And as you said, the hunger of Bencic to wrench it away from her was very impressive. But Jabeur's hungry too, isn't she?
Yeah. Is she in a similar place to Sakkari at the moment, Jabeur? Like, doing a lot of winning in terms of matches has improved her ranking so much, but you look at both career records, they've both only won one title. Jabeur in Birmingham, was it last year, and Sakkari, I think, Rabat a few years ago, 250 titles. Feels like their careers deserve more than that. It feels like they should have won more than that, and yet there's probably a reason why they haven't. They're just not quite getting over the line in tournaments. But yeah, they're both great players to watch. They're both hungry. They both want it so much. And they're both, you know, top players. But getting over the line in tournaments is proving a little bit tricky for both of them. I sort of group them together in my mind a little bit at the moment for that reason.
I'm getting on to the what does this mean section of the Bencic discussion now. Is she in the category of player like, you know, Yelena Ostapenko, where it's pointless having the what does this mean discussion, because she won Olympic gold last year and she was brilliant and it didn't really mean anything other than Belinda Bencic now always has an Olympic gold medal in her draw and that's amazing for her career and I'm really happy for her. But in terms of what it means for tennis, I feel not that the landscape didn't shift at all. And I feel in a similar position now, it doesn't really change how I feel like she might challenge at the French Open, for example.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I have the same thing watching Bencic. I enjoy it in the moment, and I think, oh, what's going to be next? And that's probably unfair, but that has been, I suppose, the story of her career a little bit. I think what it means for Bencic is that she's physically strong again. You know, she's had a tough start to the year. She had COVID and long COVID, perhaps even it, because it lingered afterwards. She was physically not at her best at the start of the season. Well, as I said, she had a lot of tight, tough, physically demanding matches in Charleston, same as she did in Miami. That's back-to-back weeks where she's put together really strong performances. So sort of short-term, it means she's back in a really good place, and that's positive. But I'm not making any Bencic predictions for the clay court season.
If David were here, he'd be making wild Bencic predictions, wouldn't he? Didn't he pick her to win Miami?
Yes, that's right. Because of the head-to-head with Osaka, and they were on a semi-final collision course. Of course, Osaka turned that one round, just as Bencic did actually to Badosa. Again, that was another reason why that was such an impressive win, because Badosa led that head-to-head 3-0, I think, going into that, and including one in Charleston last year. So for Bencic to flip that was another reason why this was just such a big week for her.
Yeah, now staying on that for a moment, as the person responsible for compiling and composing the newsletter, Matt, you know that I've gone big on Paula Badosa in 2022.
I no longer really ask what Catherine wants to predict every week. It's just Paula Badosa, please.
But now I'm in a situation where the week that I don't pick her will be the week that she wins, obviously. So I feel really like I've just got to stay committed, you know, like you're at a blackjack table and you've gone black, and you can clearly tell from the way I'm doing this analogy, I have never in my life been at a blackjack table, but I hope you know where I was going with that. I've picked her I picked her to win the Australian Open, but basically since I watched her play in Sydney
when she was amazing.
I've picked her to win pretty much everything, and she's played some good tennis since then, hasn't she? It's been a good solid year. I mean, she had the chance to become world number one in Miami, but it hasn't been quite right, I don't think, by the new standards by which we judge Paula Badosa. It hasn't been quite right, and she did put out a post in the last 24 hours saying she's not going to be in the team for Spain's Billie Jean King Cup tie that's upcoming because she references very vague physical and medical problems that she's been struggling with. Now, that's too vague for us to really analyse. And, you know, she came very close to beating the eventual champion Belinda Bencic last week. So it's hopefully not something serious, but what I'm coming around to here, Matt, is, you know, the reason that my many Badosa predictions haven't come true is that she's not quite right physically. There's something going on. Are you willing to validate that for me?
Yes, I think so. And now she's put out this statement, I sort of go back over some of the results she's had this year, and recently in Miami she really was struggling. She won a match when she was ill. She then pulled out against Jessica Pegula in the quarterfinals. And, you know, she's gone to Charleston. She's tried to play there. She had a good week. She won a couple of matches, lost the eventual champion. But I think it's good for her that she's decided to take a break, like just stop and try and get anything underlying sorted out and feel better physically. Because this should be the time of the season where, okay, she's not cleaning up because got Świątek, she's got a lot of good players who can play on clay, but you sort of feel like clay still is Badosa's best surface, or should be her best surface with the way she plays. Makes so much sense for her game, so hopefully she can overcome that. But it does offer an explanation as to why the results maybe haven't quite been what we thought they might be, or what you think they might be every week.
I can at least have a week off from picking Paula Badosa.
That's true, actually.
Thank you for that relief, Paula. So a title for Belinda Bencic in Charleston, her first on clay, and a title for Riley Opelka in Houston, his first on clay. He beat John Isner 6-3, 7-6 in the final. Now, we have some disclosing to do here. Neither Matt or I watched that final, and not because we were unable to, or... I mean, just straight up dereliction of duty that we completely own. It was watching that or watching the final round of the Masters, and we watched the final round of the Masters, and I think we feel pretty okay about that choice, Matt. In the words of Matt Roberts about 12 hours ago, the listeners don't need us to tell them what happened in Opelka Isner.
Although I was surprised that there was a break of serve.
Yeah,
didn't see it coming.
We don't know how that happened. 6-3, 7-6. There was a break of serve in the opening set. I'm sure highlights are available somewhere if you'd like to know exactly how Opelka broke the Isner serve. I reckon there was a double fault in that game. What do you think?
Oh, do you reckon?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Actually. Otherwise, they're not getting near enough enough returns. Yeah, no, that's a good call, actually.
Yeah, what do you think? Juice, tense juice game or a break to love? No, tense juice game. Yeah. Yeah. A thrashed return winner, forehand down the line.
Yeah, just connect with one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the second set, folks, was a tie break.
Correct.
So,
yeah. It's interesting how Opelka always beats Isner. I think he's won the last five. I mean, they've genuinely all been tie breaks, I think, most of those sets. So it's, you know, there is nothing between them. But
God, that's got to be tough for Isner, hasn't it? Always losing to sort of, I don't know, Isner 2.0, I guess.
And Opelka kind of is Isner 2.0. He is a better version of Isner. He's better from the baseline, I think, generally. And actually, I think he got to the semis in Rome last year, Opelka. Like, he can play on clay, and I think the slow surface probably does help his return, actually. Maybe not against Isner, but certainly against other players, he just gets that more time on the ball. But I think it's interesting to think of Opelka as a better Isner. Like, he's having better results younger as well. I always think Isner and Karlovic took a bit of time to maybe get the best results of their career, which is weird because you think, well, how much figuring out of that game is there? You know, it's so obvious what their game is. But actually, I do think it takes these big servers a bit of time to develop, whereas Opelka has developed quicker. But like Isner, I still associate him with doing best in America, or in North America anyway. He got to the Canada final, didn't he? Most of his results have been in the US or in Canada so far, his best results. And that's the same with Isner. So I think if there's going to be more of a development from Opelka, it's kind of this time of year, where Isner's never really committed to clay that much. He's never had results on the clay. But Opelka might be able to do that, I think, because, as I said, he is better off the ground than Isner. So I'm interested to watch Opelka. Well, I'm interested to see Opelka's results on the clay court season, that's for sure.
He beat Nick Kyrgios in the semi-finals, did Riley Opelka, but can take no credit for that because apparently that defeat was the umpire's fault, Matt.
Of course.
A tournament victory for Riley Opelka with an assist for the umpire. What can you say? Do you want to say anything?
See discussion from last week, probably the week before, maybe even the week before that. Has Kyrgios got a fine every tournament he's played this year? It feels like it.
Did he get one for Houston last week? Because he certainly got Indian Wells and Miami fines back to back, and absolutely rightly so. And again, he's doubled down on it on Twitter. Umpires seem to make these mistakes a little too often. A lot of players seem dissatisfied with the performance of them this week in Houston. More punishment, potentially new umpires.
It's just so tired, isn't it?
So he can't take responsibility for losing. It has to be someone else's fault.
And by all accounts, the umpire did make a bad call.
Sure.
But absolutely, this is not how you deal with it. Nick Kyrgios plays bad shots.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. So that's Nick Kyrgios. He took care of David's prediction for the week, Tommy Paul.
He was playing really well. It was a classic. It was exactly the story of Indian Wells, of Miami. You know, it's the same. He's playing really well. And then, as you said, he gets to a match that he can't necessarily just win. And
but that this is what his ego can't handle, I don't think. Playing really well, being good form, being, you know, good, relatively good shape, being in a good place, and just not being good enough. I think that's why, you know, there's so much blame being apportioned around. So that was ATP Houston. Anything else from there? Oh, Riley Opelka dived headfirst into a child-sized paddling pool in order to celebrate victory.
Are all paddling pools child size?
Well, when Riley Opelka's in them, they are. They look it.
Yeah. I just think as a concept, they're a children's thing, aren't they?
Good question, Matt. yeah, quite possibly. It might have been an adult-sized paddling pool, though, but just made to look child-sized by the by the presence of Riley Opelka in it. Apparently, the club where the tournament is held does have a swimming pool, but it was under reconstruction. So not to miss out on a photo opportunity, they inflated a paddling pool and got Riley Opelka to sort of Jürgen Klinsmann style slide into it. Footage available on the internet if you would like to do it. Also from Houston, footage available on the internet. Some little social media videos that Blair Henley, friend of the pod, hello Blair, has been doing with the players and in Charleston too, actually. I think it must have been Nick McCarville in Charleston doing that portion of the videos. Anyway, asking, you know, little fun questions to the players, and one of them was, what's your sense of direction like? And the answer that Sam Querrey gives sounds like a threat. Sounds and looks like a threat.
Yeah, Sam Querrey's coming to find you.
He says, I'm a bloodhound. I can go to a city for one night, go to a restaurant, and 10 years later, I will be able to go back to that city and hunt you down and find you, he says, with a sort of dead-eyed stare into camera. Absolutely terrifying.
And yet, in the same video, he also says that he lost his wedding ring and never found it. So you're not putting your skills to good use, Sam.
Very, very confusing Sam Querrey content from the week. Couple of other events we had going on last week. We had a win for Tatiana Maria at the WTA event in Bogota. Two qualifiers in the final. First WTA final between two players ranked outside the top 100. She beat Laura Pigossi 6-3, 4-6, 6-2 in the final there.
Outside of the top 200, I think.
Did I say 100?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the number 200 in front of me. There's a disconnect between brain and mouth.
And Pigossi had never even won a WTA main draw match before. I knew the name, and the reason I knew the name is because she won bronze at the Olympics last year in the doubles with Luisa Stefani for Brazil. They got in really late and they had an amazing run. I think they beat Kudermetova and Vesnina in that bronze medal match, and they were just great scenes at the end. You know, they were both so happy to have won bronze. But I hadn't quite realised that she'd never had the tour results to go with that, certainly in singles. So yeah, pretty great stories on both sides there, Tatiana Maria and Pigossi.
She'd never previously won a WTA main draw match, Pigossi.
Wild.
That really is wild, isn't it? And Maria, the first mother of two this century to lift a WTA trophy. She gave birth to her first daughter, Charlotte, in 2013. Her second daughter, Cecilia, just over a year ago in April 2021. And returned to action following her second maternity leave last August. That's on the WTA website. So brilliant story in Bogota. On the men's side, there was a title in Marrakesh for... Wait for it, folks. David Goffin. Remember him? When do you think we last talked about David Goffin on the podcast?
Well, there was a stat going around that it was his first title in just over a year.
What?
Which I think was meant to imply that it had been a really long time. That was way more recently than I thought it was.
When was his last title.
So his last title, I think, was Montpellier, maybe, last year.
Oh, okay.
But I think since then, he's barely won a match. He'd really struggled. He'd been in the wilderness, basically, not winning matches. I don't even think about David Goffin anymore.
No. Do you know he's only 31? I would have thought he was 34, 35. I mean, 31 is nothing for a tennis player these days. We could have years of talking about David Goffin.
He had a good Davis Cup weekend about a month ago. I watched him in that, and I think he needed that. He loves that competition, and he's always performed well in Davis Cup, even when he's perhaps been slumping on the tour. And perhaps that's just given him a little boost, because he beat some proper clay courters, Carbias Baena, Dominic Juma, Pablo Andujar, who was the second favourite for the title.
Mm.
In 2022?
After Felix Auger-Aliassime, who lost to the eventual finalist, Alex Molcan. I mean, obviously Molcan capitalising on that victory brilliantly, but this is a run of bad losses for Felix Auger-Aliassime. I'm very confused.
Yeah, I think we still probably need more data, because I still think his start to the season was so good that he's got a lot of credit in the bank. But it's declining at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not going to do a Badosa and keep picking him, I don't think. I haven't made a Monte Carlo prediction, but I don't think it's going to be Felix Auger-Aliassime.
No, and I don't think he loves clay. I think in theory he should. Like, you feel like that big topspin ground stroke should like clay. But actually, he's had really good results on grass. He likes quicker, slicker surfaces, I think.
Okay, well, there's a lot of clay to come. So, oh dear. A few other quite significant bits and bobs, actually, from the week that was, before we turn our attention to Monte Carlo. The ATP has announced that they're going to be introducing stricter punishment for on-court misconduct. The ATP told its players that it was also reviewing its penalties for serious violations and repeat offenders. This is from a BBC article, and it references the fines that Nick Kyrgios received after his outbursts in both Indian Wells and Miami. Of course, Alexander Zverev being thrown out of the Mexican Open after very aggressively hitting the umpire's chair with his racket. Incidentally, Zverev and Melo last seen in Acapulco, in the scene of that horrible outburst from Zverev after their defeat. They've been given a wild card into Monte Carlo this week as a doubles pairing. Not sure how we all feel. Well, actually, I'm sure.
Exactly how I feel
I'm
about
sure
that.
How I feel about that. In a letter that was seen by Reuters, the ATP, in a letter to the players, this was, said the incidents shine a bad light on our sport. Effectively, immediately, and as we head into the clay court swing, the ATP officiating team has been directed to take a stricter stance in judging violations of the code of conduct. This is the words of ATP chairman Andrea Gaudenzi. Said, additionally, we are also undertaking a review of the code, as well as the disciplinary processes, to ensure that it provides appropriate and up-to-date penalties for serious violations and repeat offenders. This is a really, really good thing, isn't it? And I think a review of the code and how it's applied is essential now, given the punishment that was handed out to Alexander Zverev that tied their hands in terms of punishments for lesser offences. I think so. If that's what the current code of conduct, if that's how the current code of conduct reviews that Alexander Zverev offence, then that code of conduct needs revision urgently.
Yes, I agree. I just hope it comes with some kind of empowering of umpires from the ATP and, I don't know, public support, really. I would say, when they do interpret the code of conduct in this new way and are more strict, because there will be backlash from players. And so often you see umpires just have to take a load of shit, really, from players on the court and not get any kind of public support. And players can use social media to continue to hound them after the match, and umpires are just left hung out to dry during these incidents. So I hope that the ATP sort of publicly supports their umpires in in backing them when they make these decisions, because I think that's important. Otherwise they might be, you know, they might quite understandably be hesitant to pick players up for stuff.
Yeah, and for all those players out there that are calling for, you know, the quality of officiating to improve, rightly or wrongly, the way to ensure quality officiating is not to make it the most undesirable profession imaginable, which I feel like it currently is. I mean,
yes,
who would want to be an umpire right now?
Yeah.
So yes, I share that hope, but that's a really positive announcement from the ATP. We've also had a rather different announcement from Joe Wilfried Tsonga, who is going to retire at the French Open this year. He's going to play up to and including the French Open. Wonderful place for him to retire. Look, frankly, he hasn't been a factor on tour for a few years, has he? Again, sort of, when was the last time we really spoke about Joe Wilfried Tsonga? But I think my favourite memory of him did come at the French Open. I think it was that win over Kei Nishikori back in 2015, and the way he celebrated that win on that Philippe Chatrier court. I mean, there are some Wimbledon moments as well that really stick out for me for Tsonga, but I think if I had to pick one, it would be that moment in 2015. And yeah, I think that'd be quite emotional when he retires in Paris.
Yeah, it will be. I was there that day.
I was just going to say, were you there for that? But the last time I did a were you there for that, you absolutely weren't there for that. So I backed off.
No, I was at the airport last time you asked where I was. Yeah. No, but this day I was on the court. It was the match where some of the stadium fell down on some spectators, and there was a big break in play, and that was a break which helped Nishikori get back into it and really made it a contest. But the atmosphere that day when Tsonga won has always stayed with me. That has kind of been my favourite Tsonga memory as well. And as you said, people will talk about beating Federer from two sets down at Wimbledon, or that incredible run he had in Toronto where he beat Federer, Murray and Djokovic to win the title. Obviously his Australian Open final run against Nadal as well. But yeah, watching Tsonga in France with everyone in that stadium pulling for him was just a perfect example of what Tsonga could do as a tennis player. He was magnetic, the way he played. That combination of power and touch, I think people loved. And that celebration that he had was so iconic. You were waiting for it after the match, that he would jump around, pointing at himself, leaping into the air. Those were special Tsonga moments, and that match sort of absolutely epitomised him and what he could do. And it has been a bit of a sad end to his career. I think I actually thought he would have retired by now. He's had a lot of health issues. Hasn't he got sickle cell anemia,
yeah.
Which makes travel in particular very difficult for him. And he's had some physical issues as well. So he's sort of hung on the last few years, but I hope he gets an amazing send off in Paris, because he really deserves that. He's been a big player the last 15 years. He's brought a lot to men's tennis.
It's the beginning of an end, isn't it? The end of the golden generation of men's tennis that have been gold plated rather than golden. Maybe that's even too generous relative to what was expected of them 15, 20 years ago. We are, you know, in the next few years, maybe even sooner than that, going to see the retirements of Gael Monfils, Richard Gasquet, Gilles Simon. I don't know what to do with Lucas Pouille in this situation, but I'll throw his name in there. He's only 28 years old, but it isn't a factor in tennis anymore. But goodness me, if you told French tennis fans 15 years ago, none of them would win a slam. And only Tsonga would reach a slam final, and just the one. Wow.
Yeah. And they haven't got the generation following them. Like Spain at the moment, everyone in Spain is just rubbing their hands together, because for a while you were wondering, where are the next Spanish players? Because you had Nadal, you had Lopez, you had Ferrer, but then there was a gap. Now they've got Carlos Alcaraz. And France have got, again, of course, they've they've still got depth. They've got Humbert, they've got Gaston, they've got Rinderknecht, they've got Bonzi. You know, they've got players, but they don't seem to quite be as good as that group were. As you said, all the names there, top 10 players. And yet, even though they're top 10 players, there's a feeling of, they didn't quite do what we thought they were going to, what we hoped they would do.
But maybe Matt, maybe Guillaume Fils still will.
Mm.
I only need one.
I only need one.
I mean, he has actually, before we big up his chances of winning just that one Grand Slam too much, he has withdrawn from Monte Carlo. He's not going to be able to start his clay court season until at least Madrid. He says, I'm planning to be back in time for Madrid. He's got a foot issue and doctors have advised him to rest. But because we just love to talk about the hope and the possibility of Guillaume Fils, David this week has been speaking to Yannick Noah, as he is wont to do every sort of 18 months or so. David just has an electric 2-hour long conversation with Yannick Noah. Now, the main purpose of that conversation, I'll try not to spoiler here, was to gather content for our upcoming Tennis Relived series ahead of Roland Garros, which will be available on our for Friends of the Tennis podcast. But, you know, it would be rude not to pick the brains of Yannick Noah about all things tennis while you've got him on the line, especially as it's taken so many attempts to get him on the line. David, I think on average he gets stood up 3 times before he actually tracks down Yannick Noah, and it's always worth it in the end, but it's a saga.
Yeah, and it's like every time he gets stood up, it comes with interest. Like, Yannick Noah will give you an extra 10 minutes for every time he's left you hanging. So yeah. That's why all these calls with him end up being so long and amazing.
And look, he just had some really incredible things to say about Guillaume Fils. And we listened to them back and we thought, well, if we don't play you this now, then it'll probably never see the light of day. And it definitely deserves to see the light of day. These are the thoughts of Yannick Noah on Guillaume Fils and whether he can win just that one slam.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Well, I think Gaël never in his career worked for 2 months nonstop. Never. I'm talking about work. It's not that Gaël just said, I want to be in the top 15 players in the world for another 3 years. That's different. But if he wants to win a Grand Slam, which I believe in a way he could, physically he's fresh, technically can do it. But the problem is, I do not believe, because he never did it, he has never been a tennis player 100% for more than a couple of weeks. That's what I believe. And it's not easy. And it's not a critique. It's not judgmental. I love Gael. I think he's the greatest, one of the two or three players, most fun player on the tour when he's on. So when I say that, it's because I always try to get my message across in many ways, you know, through you, through calls that we had sometimes. Sometimes I sent him like a little message on Instagram. I had him, you know, I coached him for one game, you know, on Davis Cup. I'm trying because I'm like, I would love for him to win a Grand Slam, because if he wins a Grand Slam, like winning seven matches, this, I can see a build up around him. I can see the energy that could be around him, and I could see the, and I can picture the joy, you know, not only of him, but whatever he represents, which is the Showtime tennis, you know. And but he has to work. He has to work, you know. And winning is not just making one great game. It's like winning a match where you don't play so well, and then when you're on, you win, you beat anyone, but you have to be prepared to win seven matches in a row in five sets. And for that, you have to prepare yourself physically and mentally. You cannot do that just being ready 10 days at that level. Like Rafa is used to it because he's been doing this like 10 months a year for the last 15 years. So for him to turn it on is kind of, I'm not saying easy, but he's used to it. Same for the top guys, right? But Gael never did it. Gael never did it. There's always something for 2-3 days that he has to do something else, or is concentrating on something else, or being excited about something else, or being depressed about something, whatever it is. Just 2 months. If he does that, he'd better do it in the next couple of years, because that time flies. So could he, like, he could start today and win the French. That would be a good thing. You know, starts today, you win the French, but 2 months. So that's what I believe. I think it's worth it.
I think it's worth it too. I always think, you know, it's interesting that you found that balance that 1 year, and obviously you contended other years as well. But you did, you loved the show. You loved the excitement the same way that he does on the court, and you make people happy in the crowd and all that sort of thing. But you still won as well. You managed to do the same. Is that because of that you realized that 2 months was required? Was there a moment that it dropped?
Gael is playing the way I played after I won the French. After I won the French, I never found a real purpose. I was playing, I was practicing, but it was not this thing of life and death, about working on my destiny, a real deep purpose. I had that when I won the French Open. I don't care about the way I played, but my face, I had a purpose. I was not just practicing playing tennis. I had a purpose. And once I won the French, I achieved that. And then I never after as a player found a purpose. And then I became number three in the world. And then I won some tournaments, but it was not the same. And that's the way Gael is playing. He doesn't play with his purpose. I don't see it. I see the showman I was when I was 28, just playing, enjoying, you know, winning some match, some tournaments too, but not this purpose, not this urgency of, hey, if I don't do that, I missed my career. I missed my life. You know, I don't see that in Gael. And I see the Yannick in the 20s. People tend to remember this side of me, some people, when I was like, you know, more of a showman. But before that, I was not a showman before the French Open, before I won the French Open. I became a showman after, because I didn't have the same purpose. I achieved my goal and I never found another goal. I never had this goal that, you know, this thing that makes you wake up in the morning saying, okay, this is why I'm doing. I could wake up in the morning, go practice 5 hours, but it was not the same thing. And this is the way he plays. He goes through the motion. He plays well, he wins. He doesn't play well, he loses. Comes to the press, oh, I didn't have a good day. Before the French Open, when I lost the match, I was crying, man. You know, I was hurt, you know, but hurt in my soul. You know, he doesn't have that. And he could. But the interesting thing when he says, I want to win a Grand Slam, the second question, which is the most important, would be, why do you want to win a Grand Slam? And I would be very interested to hear the answer that he gives, if he has one. I don't believe he has one, on the why he wants to win a Grand Slam. And if he does have a clear answer to that, that would be like a big step. But I doubt he has it.
What was your answer to that question, if somebody had said to you why?
No, you know, I come from France, you know. I come from France. As I grew up as a player, and Cameroon, of course, but as I grew up, all around me was about how French people cannot make it. How French people always get to the finals and never makes it. All. So very early I said, okay, I'm going to be the one that's going to make this happen. Win. I wanted to win. One, to prove to the whole environment around me, since I was a child, all I heard in soccer, in football, we're good, but we lose in the finals. You know, we were finding philosophy about how to lose beautifully. There's a lot of books about how to lose beautifully. And I didn't like that. There was something about me, I didn't like that. I wanted to be different, I guess. And I wanted to win. But it was that I won in France, in Paris, with everybody around me, all the family, the whole people that I wanted to prove that a French can win, not me, but a French can win. This is what I wanted. Well, not just Yannick's going to win. No, I wanted to prove that me with my dreads, whatever I represented for people, but people like us, French, African, we can win. And I was deep in, so I had that. And once I did it, well, actually, I felt depressed for like 6 months. You know, I was depressed. So now everybody talk about depression. Back in the day, nobody understood what I was going through. But now, you know, a lot of people talk about this mental situation of being a tennis professional. So, but back in the days, of course, they didn't get it. So I was like, I felt like kind of a loneliness first as a person. And for me to even go back on a tennis court, I decided to play, to have a family and have kids and just play tennis. But it was totally different. I proved myself and the people that I wanted to prove to that we can win as French people. Same way with Davis Cup. When we won the Davis Cup, it was the same. We didn't win for 50 years. What the fuck? 50 years? So I said, okay, I'm going to try to prove that we can win. So we won that time. And then I said, okay, I think I understand. I got something. And we tried it a few times and we won a few times. But that was like the purpose. It's important to have like a purpose, especially for us, like in France. We don't have a culture of winning. It's not like in the States or other countries. We don't have a culture of winning. You know, sports is fun, you know. But when you are like in other countries, like, you know, I have American, my kids are from the States. So when you go for sports to win, it's important. You try to win. Us, it's like more of a leisure kind of vibe, you know. So sometimes I see some of my players and some of the players I watch now, French guys, they just happy to be there. It's cool, which is okay. You know, yeah, no judgment. But I mean, once you decide and you declare like Gael or Luca or Joe Tsonga, they said, I want to win. Joe Tsonga said one day when he lost in the finals at the Australian Open, like his first final, he said, no, I don't want to win one. I want to win many. Wow. You want to win many Grand Slams, man? And look what happened, you know? It's hard. And for that, not only that you have to have a purpose, but you have to have the people around you understanding. And we don't have a culture of winning in France. We don't have that. We don't have that. So it's tough.
But 2 months, Gael. Start today.
Every day, every night. All the thing, all you think about is playing the... He sleeps every ball you hit with a purpose, really. Thinking about the French every moment. You got to play Nadal, man. This is no, you know, this is serious. You want to beat Rafa? Rafa is taking a break right now. So when Rafa is coming, he's going to be ready. He might win lose a set or two in the first rounds, but, you know, coming the quarter, he's going to start playing again, you know. So you'd better be ready. So it's a big deal. Winning a French or winning a Grand Slam for this generation is a big deal. Not like us. It was easier for us. Easier. I'd say easy, but easier. Now you have to beat these guys. These guys are playing well, man. So, yeah. And I always felt, even though he did great at the US Open, for some reason, I always felt that Gael could win the French. I always felt that Gael could win the French. I saw him play some great matches, but it always comes short because physically there's always a little something, which it comes because of the preparation. Yeah, two months. What it's like? Yeah, it's perfect timing. We April, May, ready to go.
Or maybe just May, given that he's got a foot injury that's taking him out for the whole of April. I mean, it sounds like he's like us, Yannick Noah. There's a bit of him that believes, but there's also a very rational, practical portion of him. I mean, in terms of the finding a reason thing, can the reason, I mean, I realise, sorry, Matt, that you're not the person to ask this question to. Yannick Noah probably is. Can the reason not just be, I really, 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 really want to win a Grand Slam?
I'd have thought so. And I think that is now Monfils's reason.
Yeah.
I found that analysis absolutely fascinating from Yannick Noah. And Yannick Noah knows Gael Monfils well. You know, he's worked with him. He's got an insight into his mindset. He's been his Davis Cup captain. But I think what we've been saying is there has been a shift in Monfils in the last few months, especially the start of this year. And there has been, I don't know, a realization that he doesn't want to be a highlights reel player, that he wants to win, yeah, one time. I just need it one time. Ugh. Need it. It wasn't want it, it was need it. And gosh, I mean, it's kind of hard because of this injury now, but Yannick Noah saying that in Yannick Noah tones has a way of making you think that it's possible.
Gael Monfils relived coming your way in a few years. We've got the audio already lined up. we'll continue to dream while it's still a possibility. In terms of injuries, we've had post-surgery social media posts this week from Daniil Medvedev, who's had his hernia operation, from Matteo Berrettini, who's had that hand operation. But he is out of Monte Carlo, Madrid and Rome. He said, it's crucial I do not put time pressure on my recovery process. Withdrawing from these events, particularly Rome, is an extremely tough decision. However, it's the right one to ensure many more years of competing at the highest level for the biggest trophies. That's got to be gutting for Berrettini, really gutting, especially given what happened in Turin at the end of last year. Oh, I feel for him.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same thing. He is the best Italian player at the moment, and he's missing the chance to have, you know, events in Italy when he's the best player. And that just must be so gutting for him. Happened in Turin. He can't play Rome now. Yeah, it's a real, real shame for him. And we saw how hard he took it, missing out in Turin last year. Mid-match, he had to retire, didn't he? Yeah. And it's also, you wonder what the knock-on effect is in terms of maybe less so the French Open, but the grass court season is around the corner, and he's got points to defend. That's the surface where he has an edge over a lot of the other players who are trying to win a slam. You know, he's better on grass than a lot of them, and if he's not at his best for that portion of the season, that'll be another thing he's missed out on. So yeah, really, really bad timing for him.
So no Monfils, no Berrettini in the Monte Carlo draw, but don't worry, folks, the draw did not disappoint. Carlos Alcaraz and returning to the tour Novak Djokovic are in the same quarter. They both need to win two matches to get there, because, of course, they both have a bye in the opening round. Ditch byes, everyone. We've decided byes need to go. Casper Ruud is also in that top half, whereas defending champion Stefanos Tsitsipas, Felix Auger-Aliassime and his losing streak, Alexander Zverev, Andrei Rublev, they're all in the bottom half of the draw. But really, we know where eyeballs are looking in that draw. I mean, Djokovic has got to get past Alejandro Davidovich Fokina in his opener, which isn't easy to come in cold and face. I know Davidovich Fokina has done very little since the French Open last year, but with clay back beneath his feet and already with a win under his belt, because, of course, he didn't get a bye in the opening round, it's a tough cold opener for Djokovic, I would say.
It is, yeah. I think they played last year on clay and Djokovic won pretty easily. I think they've practiced together before, so he knows Davidovich Fokina's game. But still, Djokovic hasn't played for a couple of months. It's a different scenario. It's not easy. I think Taylor Fritz is in that section as well. We know that Alcaraz starts against Korda, who got a win today, and you would definitely favour Alcaraz on clay in that match. But again, that's not easy either. Gosh, I hope it happens, Alcaraz Djokovic. I was honestly really excited when I saw that draw. I just thought, right, I want to see that match. I want to see it here. I want to see it, you know, all of these clay court weeks. I want to see Alcaraz playing Djokovic and playing Nadal when Nadal is back, because it's the most exciting thing in men's tennis at the moment, Alcaraz. And I want to see him up against these best players. And because I think he'll learn quickly as well. And I kind of want him to be ready for playing them on bigger stages. Mm. So, yeah, I hope it happens. And same time, I think these events now take on more meaning for Djokovic as well. You know, we saw him in Monte Carlo last year lose to Dan Evans, and, you know, with all due respect to Dan Evans's brilliant performance that day, it was a slightly kind of subdued Djokovic that we saw in a lot of the lead-up events on clay. Suddenly, these events really matter for Djokovic, because he needs matches, he needs to play them, he needs to win. So it would be a pretty full-throttle Djokovic against an always full-throttle Alcaraz, and it's an enticing prospect.
It's a yes, please, isn't it? Yeah. All eyes on that is what the fans want to see. Speaking of what the fans want to see, Ugo and Bear.
Some fans. Mad. Young fans. Well, a queue of fans.
A queue of fans to... Well, it was like he was his own Madame Tussauds model. Or something. What?
High on the list of weirdest things you've ever seen.
Yeah, really, really high. Could you try and describe it for people that haven't caught this on the internet?
So, Ugo and Bear was put in a room. Not even a particularly nice room.
Yeah, it looked like someone's office or something. Yeah,
it's not a great background for all these pictures that people are getting. And basically, he was sort of...
He was put behind...
He was cordoned off.
He was put in an area in a room.
Yeah, and one by one, children went up to have a picture with him, but socially distanced. So they were standing, I don't know, about a metre and a half, probably, in front of him, Bear. Everyone was awkwardly posing for a photo, and the child was moved along, and the next child came in, and Bear just... stood there with a grin on his face for, I don't know how many kids there were. A lot. About 40, I think.
How many of those 40 kids do you think knew what they were queuing for?
I think they knew it was a tennis player.
Maybe it sounds... But look, you've got to see it. It's so deeply weird. And bless Ugo and Bear
It was weird and
for styling it out. Because, yeah, I think I might have refused to do that. So that is Monte Carlo. It's on the screen in front of us now. Stan Wawrinka is in action. In fact, Stan Wawrinka is serving for the opening set against Alexander Bublik. That would be an uplifting story if Stan Wawrinka could get some wins and just look a bit like his old self, to be honest. I have no expectations of this comeback whatsoever. So anything for me would be a Wawrinka bonus. Last two bits of business. Simona Halep is going to be coached by Patrick Mouratoglou, Matt. How do you react to that news?
I think my reaction was, what?
Yeah, same. It was really surprising, wasn't it? That announcement. For me, it was.
Extremely surprising. They don't feel like a personality mesh.
Hmm.
Which, you know, maybe sometimes that's what players need, someone different to them. But look, it was surprising for lots of reasons. Obviously, Serena is a big part of this as well. Also, Halep's comments early on in the year about how she was actually embracing not having a coach. You know, she said that, didn't she? She said, I'm really trying to do it on my own, do my own thing, see what I can learn about myself. Just feels like that didn't last very long. And, you know, maybe that isn't surprising, but I thought she might just give it a bit more of a go on her own. I wasn't expecting her to announce a new coach quite so quickly after those comments. And then obviously the whole Serena situation makes it all quite confusing as well, because that's all been quite vague and lots of teases.
Mm. Yeah, we won't get into those teases, will we? I don't think.
No, it was just on the same day that we had Patrick Mouratoglou announce that he was working with Simona Halep, due to conversations he'd had with Serena that he said gave him a
freedom. Is that the word?
Freedom or time and space in the short term, anyway, to work with another player. And I think most people were reading into that, well, Serena's not coming back anytime soon then.
Mm.
And then on the same day, Serena puts out a video in which she says she's been training for Wimbledon and is hoping to come back. I mean, I think Serena does do that sort of thing. Mm. She knows what she's doing. I wouldn't read too much into it. I think she said before she would play events that she hasn't played. But the whole thing was quite confusing on that day.
And she also, a reminder, and this is a repeat of content from our most recent Friends Pod, a listener questions podcast that went up last week, when we were asked about which of Federer, Serena and Venus we would see again, if any. And you reminded us of that quote from Serena at the Australian Open last year. What did she say?
She said, "If I ever said farewell, I wouldn't tell anyone," which I think about that a lot.
Mm. Mm. It's an important line, I think. Anyway,
is Napalka's on the telly suddenly?
Oh, did they show the break of serve?
They didn't.
No, okay. So we still can't fill you in on that, folks. Homework for you if you really, really want to know what happened there. Unfortunately, last bit of news to cover off. Not much to say about this, really, other than the really sad news, really, of Boris Becker being found guilty of 4 charges under the Insolvency Act in the UK relating to his 2017 bankruptcy. This from the BBC News website. Former world number one was accused of hiding millions of pounds worth of assets to avoid paying his debts. Declared bankrupt in June 2017 over an unpaid loan of more than £3 million. He was acquitted of a further 20 charges at Southwark Crown Court on Friday. Cleared of 9 counts of failing to hand over trophies and medals from his career, including 2 Wimbledon men's singles trophies. He told reporters outside the court he would not be commenting on the verdict. He was found guilty of transferring hundreds of thousands of pounds from his business account after his bankruptcy, failing to declare a property in Germany and concealing about €825,000 worth of debt. He could face a jail sentence carrying a maximum term of 7 years for each count. And the sentencing hearing is set for April the 29th. So we'll update you on that really sad situation once the sentencing has been handed down. Sorry to end on a bum note. Stan Wawrinka's won the opening set. That's a better note. Sorry, Bublik, but that's nice to see.
Yeah, let's focus on that.
Mm. Yes, we have a weekly mascot, folks, and it is Luca, an 11-year-old English cream golden retriever owned by Cynthia. Why am I not looking at a picture of Luca? I am looking at a picture of Luca. Matt held up his laptop just in time. Luca is lovely, smiling on a beach, wearing, is that a bandana? I do approve.
It is a bandana.
Mm. Love that. Love a dog on a beach. They always just look so joyful.
Thank you. Out.
Thank you, Luca. And thank you for Cynthia for bringing Luca into our lives. We have our mascots. David has Darwin. I've got Carter. Matt's got Gerald the cat. Billie Jean has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our two executive producers, Kyle Weingartner and Chris Albert Lee. And we have shout outs.
We have Adam Maundrell from Sydney.
Oh, okay. Adam. It's not a very Tennessee name, Adam, is it?
No.
I immediately thought of Adam Scott, the golfer, because we're still in sort of Masters mode.
Yeah, and he's Australian.
And he's Australian, yeah. I don't think there are any tennis Adams. Let us know, folks.
I cannot think of any.
That's a strange anomaly, isn't it?
It's like the fact that there are too many Ks in tennis, not enough Adams.
Mikhail Kukushkin responsible for so many of them. thank you very much, Adam, for your support.
We also have Alison Copley from Norwich.
Oh, hello. My brother went to university in Norwich. And I'm going to see the Killers at Carrow Road.
Oh, yes,
later this year. Yeah.
Yes, and Fulham will never play Norwich again.
No.
We're in a purgatory land.
He's mentioned Fulham again, folks. It's annoying. thank you very much, Alice. There are tennis Alisons, aren't there?
Yes.
Van Oytvank. Any others? No. Okay. Thank you very much, Alison, for your support. It is much appreciated.
And finally today, we have a birthday shout out, a surprise birthday shout out for Samantha. And that is courtesy of Samantha's partner, Andrew. Andrew says, love from Maggie, our 9-month-old baby, Pixie, our British bulldog, Cadel, our border collie, Jack Russell Cross, Moon, our house pony, and Andrew himself. And Samantha and Andrew are in Australia. So happy birthday, Samantha.
What is a house pony?
Called Moon.
What? Seriously, Matt, what is a house pony? I'm stand by, folks. If anyone's still listening, stand by while I Google house pony. A little town ride-on pony available at Aldi has just come up. Also, though, a picture of meet the ponies who live in their owners' homes. And there's a picture of a woman sat by a fire in an armchair accompanied by a pony. Wow. Hello, Samantha. Happy birthday. Please get in touch and tell us more about Moon, your house pony. And if photos are available of all of your animals together, house pony included, please, please send those to us. But most importantly, happy birthday. Thank you for being a fan of the Tennis Podcast. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Monday with a weekly show. We'll also be back for Friends of the Pod on Thursday with another listener question special. There are some comments about David's holiday and tan that won't have aged well, folks.
I told you that I didn't like recording podcasts that go out a week later due to unforeseen events which might make them out of date.
I promise it's a great pod and well worth listening to, well worth becoming a friend of the pod if you haven't already. But even if David makes it to Croatia, he won't have a tan at that time.
Not by Thursday.
Not by Thursday. So those comments are unfortunately out of date. But do listen anyway. Do become a friend of the pod. Do subscribe to the newsletter. Leave us an Apple Podcasts review. Do all that jazz. And we will see you for another weekly show next Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ,
the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.